The trees, too, were gleaming. From somewhere farther, he heard the gentle tinkle of wind chimes. Seeing Zani, he went to join her. "The boy's asleep," he said, sitting down next to her. "Good," she said. "He liked the story I told, although I fear he may have thought it was all true." They sat companionably for a while, looking out across the gardens. Under the lamps, a small group of women had gathered together to perform a set of exercises, rather like Tai Chi, Picard thought. He breathed deeply. Night flowers were blooming and releasing their scent. The whole place had a blissful feel to it. "This has been a good home," she said. "But times have changed, and to try to remain here would be self-deception. I regret, though, that we shall not have a chance to bring in the harvest. It is a great waste." A sadness washed over Picard at the thought of all the harvests that would not be gathered as this tragedy unfolded. Fruits and crops left to rot on abandoned worlds, the people who had cared for them dragged far, far away. And at last, the great fire that would consume them all. He collected himself. "It has not escaped my notice," he said, "that you're all women."
"Yes, indeed."
A smile quirked across her face.
"No surprise to me that Elnor took to you. He rarely sees men."
"There was T'Juth." She gave him a look that said, "Unlikely." "How did Elnor come to be with you?" Her face saddened.
"He was left with us. Abandoned. If there is a mother or father still alive, we don't know. The intention was to find him a home as quickly as we could. Our houses don't permit males, not even boys. But when a home is not to be found, what is to be done? He was safe with us, and so I decided he should remain."
"You broke the rules of your order?"
"Yes, I broke the rules, and I shall continue breaking them as long as Elnor remains safe."
"Are you shocked, Admiral?" She gave him an amused glance.
"I don't know a great deal about Starfleet, but you do seem fond of rules and regulations."
"I believe," he said, "that my superiors might wish I was more of a stickler for them."
"Oh," she said in surprise, "do you have superiors?"
"One or two."
"I imagined you were the leader."
He was both touched by the compliment and diverted at the thought, and surprised to some extent at her unworldliness in this respect. She had otherwise struck him as very practical, very grounded. Perhaps it was simply that Starfleet had, until recently, meant nothing to her.
"Did you suffer consequences for your decision to protect the boy, Zani?"
"Consequences? None that mattered to me. Some disapproval from some of the sisters, but I am more than used to hearing their opinions voiced, and I am perfectly capable of not listening. Refusing to help Elnor would have been worse. What is the purpose of rules," she said, "if they do nothing to protect the vulnerable? No, more, succor the vulnerable. Protection is not enough. Nurture is also necessary. Elnor is nurtured. Any rule that prevented that is not worth obeying."
Listening to her words, Picard felt a deep sense of hope and love, call it fraternity or sorority or simply fellow feeling, envelop him. These were words, he realized, that he had been longing to hear said. From his superiors he heard, "Be diplomatic, consider the political ramifications." From the Romulans he met, he received demands, anger, hostility. And yet it all seemed so simple to him. It was incumbent on them to use all their talents, skills, and resources to bring relief, to help the helpless. At last, here on a hillside looking down at a Romulan world, someone had spoken straight to his heart.
"Yes," he said, "yes, that is how it is."
She smiled at him.
"Certainly not what I expected to hear from a Starfleet officer."
"There is no purpose to Starfleet if it cannot fulfill this function," he said firmly. "I will give everything to this mission. There is no more important task.
From down in the valley there came soft singing. Zani said, I will help you however I can. He had grasped already that Koat Milat did not make promises. This he understood to be a statement of fact, of clear intent. Once again he was moved. He had come this far, and at last he found someone who shared his values. He had hoped that there would be a kindred spirit among the Romulans, and he had been proved right. He must not forget this, he thought. He must not fail to hope.
8. Admiral's Log. We have begun the evacuation of Ingstis, and Zani has been as good as her word in offering us all the assistance that we require. The Koat Milat have been everywhere, soothing tempers, calming fears, persuading even the most intransigent to board our ships. My heart grieves to see this beautiful planet abandoned, to think of the homes that have been left behind, and the communities that have been transplanted. If I were a resident here, I might not have left willingly. But it seems that the Koat Milat inspire trust. I imagine this has been years in the making. Open houses to which people can come when they are lost, or friendless, or, I should guess, in trouble with the Tal Shiar. The rivalry between them is a sight to behold. Tajuth did not want them on board, and approached his ambassador to request it. I will forgive him for going behind my back. They are rather daunting en masse. Having watched a little more of the practices of these women, I understand now that they are true warriors. Old Sister Shay's wooden staff is not simply to help her walk, but conceals a rather sharp and deadly blade. I see many of the sisters carrying these staffs. Tan Galanks, they call them. Regulations state they should be surrendered before coming on board ship. I have no intention of asking, and neither does Rafi. A regulation that we are quietly ignoring. Summer is rapidly coming to an end on Ingstis, and we hope to have the entire population en route to Vashti within the next 2 weeks. This task, often so grim, has seemed less heartbreaking this time, and for this we can only thank the Koat Milat for their patience and their courage. I can see how a mother in need might choose to leave her child with these women, and trust that the right thing would be done by him. Elnor is something of a permanent presence these days. He has pronounced the little prince odd, but has nevertheless invited me to read more to him. I say invited. It was rather more in the nature of an instruction. I shall have to rack my brains to recall what I liked to read as a boy. I was something of an eccentric child, but then, I suppose, so is Elnor.
Sword Soul Township, Ingstis. Picard walked through the empty house in search of Zani. Lieutenant the Kothrek, in the transporter room, had told him that she had gone back down to the surface of Ingstis a few hours earlier, saying that she had forgotten something important.
Zani!
He called as he walked between the trunks of the big old tree. The nets were gone, folded and packed, as was everything else that had helped make this place the busy house that he had first seen. Leaves were now drifting through forlorn, bare rooms. Picard walked through and out again into the garden where he had sat with Zani on that first night, under the starlight and the lamplight. Some of the lanterns were still hanging, chains creaking in the breeze, never to be lit again. He walked on, down the path, until he reached the river. There, her skirts tied above her knees, stood Zani, up to her ankles in river water. She was skimming stones. They bounced, one, two, 3, 4.
Zani! He called out, waving when she turned to look at him.
She waved to him to join her. He stood on the bank and watched the stones, each one sending out ripples and shock waves, ring upon ring that spread across the silver stream. After a moment or two, she came to join him on the bank.
My favorite spot, she said.
I would often come here to think. She shivered and wrapped her shawl around her.
But it's cold in there today.
He put his hand upon her arm.
Let me take you home, he said, or a place that you can make home.
She turned back to the river and stretched up her arms as if to touch the sky.
Thank you, she said to the world she had lost. You have been a good home. I will remember you as long as I am able.
Then she said,
Time to go.
The Kothrek, he said. Two to beam on board.
Within seconds they were gone. The river ran on, the leaves drifted, and in the valley the wind chimes sang a song that would never be heard again. Daystrom Institute, Okinawa, Earth. Olivia Quest left nothing to chance. The Daystrom Institute was likely to be interesting, yes, but she sent Danny, one of her aides, there first and waited to receive the account of his visit. He was a slick young man who never usually deigned to rise above an air of jaded cynicism. Quest often found this pose tiresome, but he was a master of press releases, and she also owed his family several favors after the help they had given her to get elected. When his report from the synth production facility arrived, it was unexpectedly gushing, and therefore of considerable interest to her. Liv, you have got to get yourself over here ASAP. It's amazing. Bring the networks. Bring as many holo cameras as you possibly can. P.S. Happy to report that the sushi even in the cafeteria is amazing. Think you should move your office here, TBH. Ciao for now, Danny.
Quest, who had developed a warm and friendly relationship with the press during her campaign for election, and was always happy to provide them with curated content, quickly arranged passes and permits for the usual members of the Fourth Estate. They arrived in Okinawa with considerable fanfare, 40 altogether, coming through in groups of four to the faint alarm of the director of the Institute, Sisra Coas, a pleasant, if rather absent-minded and elderly trill, who allowed herself to be positioned exactly where Quest wanted her. Smiling, Quest didn't fail to notice that there were UFPHCR logos all over the place. Those guys didn't miss a trick. Inside the main building, Quest's mask of enthusiasm was replaced by something much more genuine. Steering Director Coas gently but firmly, she hurried them past the usual sights to get to the synths as quickly as possible. This involved a short monorail ride out to the far end of the campus to a long, low building that she knew was the brand new synthetics production facility. More UFPHCR logos, Starfleet logos. Where was the council in all of this? Most strikingly, the whole place gleamed. It was spacious, it was staffed, and it was all brand new. This, she thought bitterly, was where Estelin's new transporter links between the planet and its moons had gone. Earth got whatever it wanted. Quest entered the facility prepared to be angry, but she was too much of an engineer not to be blown away. She had learned from her own researches that the facility could produce up to 5 synths at any given time. Coas led her past the bioneural replication bays, the casing displays, and at last toward the 5 chambers where the final assembly of each synth happened, the place where they came to life, or to not life, as the case may be. She had to remember that they were non-sentient. They were not alive, they were machines. A member of staff standing by ran them through the final initiation process, and they all stood and watched as one of the synths was switched on. It lay there in its chamber, inert. Then the eyes flickered and opened and gleamed gold. Quest almost gasped out loud. It was like watching a spell being cast. But then she looked more closely at the eyes and saw that they were flat, blank, without any spark. They saw. They even processed, but they did not live. They could act, could even decide, but they could not judge. There was no free will here, no freedom,
This realization was almost a relief. Lurking nearby was a tall man with a beleaguered expression. After watching the A-500 perform a series of functions like a wind-up toy, she crossed over to speak to him.
Dr. Maddox, she said, I'm delighted to meet you. Your work here is very impressive.
He jerked his head as if to reject what she had said.
Credit where credit is due.
He struck her as rather prissy.
The project owes a great deal to Commander Estella McKenzie of Starfleet. She was the one who came up with the idea of combining her research into bioneural circuitry with what we can do here at the Daystrom.
Of course.
Quest waved these niceties away, thereby unwittingly earning Maddox's contempt at her airiness toward the science and his irritation that his name was the one attached to this whole damn thing.
But the real breakthrough is here, isn't it? She said. These incredible creations of yours.
She gestured at the chambers all around. Another synth was being assembled, its arms being carefully attached to its trunk.
I have to say that machines like this would have a tremendous impact on my own homeworld of Estelin.
She glanced across at the holo cameras and smiled for anyone watching.
It's a farming colony.
Is it?
Suddenly, Quest grasped that this conversation was not unfolding as successfully as she might like.
I'm sure you can see how non-sentient synthetics would be useful on worlds like that.
Yes, well, somebody has to do the dirty jobs.
Camera's word. Quest, with some effort, did not frown.
But seeing them now, seeing how complex they are, how sophisticated, well, why stop at manufacture or at farming? Surely you can see how revolutionary machines like this could be.
You'll have to enlighten me, Counselor. I merely spend my time building them.
She gave a bright smile.
They're being used for industrial applications, but why not domestic applications, too? All kinds of work. A synth in every home. Your Daystrom A-500s could be as ubiquitous as, well, as a replicator.
A more unfortunate simile Quest could not have found. Maddox went very still. Quest, unaware of the bear trap opening in front of her, carried on blithely.
You know, the more people who can see something in this project that will benefit not only, well,
she balked at saying Romulans so openly,
others, but will benefit people across the Federation, the more goodwill you earn. Not only from people like me, but from the public at large.
She laughed. Though, of course, it doesn't do any harm to keep people like me on your side.
And looking at all this, I am. I am very much on your side.
Maddox stared at her with open dislike.
That's not the point of all this, though, is it?
The cameras were watching. Quest blinked.
What do you mean?
Counselor Quest, I'm sorry to speak bluntly.
Christ, she thought. Don't do that. There are journalists here.
But I didn't get into research to please politicians. Nobody involved in research of any kind should be thinking about whether or not it pleases politicians. The work comes first. The work must always come first.
Quest gave a smile intended to smooth these unexpectedly ruffled feathers.
But political support is what gets you resources, Dr. Maddox.
Something that I find pretty repellent, to be honest.
Repellent? What do you mean?
He threw his hands up, exasperated.
I mean the politicization of research like this. The politicization of all damn research. Don't you get what we're trying to do here?
You're trying to help the relief mission. He cut her off with an impatient wave of his hand. She would never forgive it.
We're trying to create life here, he said.
There were red blotches of color on his cheeks.
Not curry favor. Politicians like you come and go, you know. Research like this takes decades.
Quest was, frankly, furious. The sheer damn nerve. Who the hell was this man, anyway? Who the hell did he think he was? Sure, a respected scientist, and brilliant, by all accounts, but had anyone elected him? There was an arrogance in some circles of Starfleet, Quest thought. You got the sense that they considered themselves unaccountable to anyone. But they were accountable, and they had to remain accountable. Maddox's manner could not go unpunished, that was for sure. But Quest was far too canny an operator not to be mindful of the journalists all around, eager for a story. She considered carefully what to say. "Well, I still think this is very fine work you're doing here," she said. "What an achievement after decades of work, Dr. Maddox. What a legacy." She turned to him. "A synth in every home." That hit, and hard. She heard good-natured laughter from all around and knew that would be the headline. She smiled and waved at the holo cameras. Maddox felt as false as the machines he had created. All through Quest's visit, he had tried to keep cheerful, tried to keep up the pretense that he was enthusiastic about the work he was doing, but finally he had cracked. A synth in every home. He knew that her parting shot had been intended to wound, and she had certainly done the job. He stood in the darkened production room, staring at the synth currently under construction. The smooth face, too perfect, lacking any blemish to give it personality or uniqueness, the golden empty eyes without any spark. A travesty of life. A joke. That was his work now. A joke. He was a punchline. Hearing footsteps, he turned to see Agnes. "Hey," she said, "how did it go?" "Oh, she loved it all," he said. "She loved everything she saw." Agnes came closer. Uncertainly, she said, "That's good, isn't it?" "Yes, great, if what I wanted to do with my life is put a synth in every home." That's what she said, you know. "That can be your legacy, Dr. Maddox, a synth in every home." "Shit!" He banged his hand against the side of the table. The synth nearby did not react. There was nothing there, and there never would be. They were inert, a mockery of life, a mockery of his life's work. He closed his eyes. He heard Agnes moving. "Bruce," she said in a muffled voice, "I'm not the enemy." Guilt spasmed through him. He turned to face her. She was chewing at her lip, looking at him apprehensively. She was so young, he thought, still so full of optimism, of hope. But hope for what? This was their work now. This was all that there would be for them. There would be nothing else. No new life, no offspring, nothing. A dead end for both of them. He realized that she was crying, very softly. She was trying hard to hide it from him. She was so smart, he forgot sometimes that she was the student and he was the professor. He reached out to touch her wrist. "Agnes," he said. "Aggie. I'm sorry, I'm so sorry. This isn't your fault."
"It's not that I think you're blaming me," she said. "I understand that you're angry. It's that you lose faith in yourself. I hate to see you like this."
He felt ashamed. She was so loyal. He didn't deserve this. He didn't deserve her.
"Aggie, I..." "This is an opportunity," she said fiercely. "You say she loved what she saw? Then use that. Use her. She's powerful, influential. She can put resources our way."
"That's what she said," Maddox said bitterly. "But to do what? She wants miners, domestic servants, field hands. Labor, not life." Not data, he thought, aching for that perfect lost creation. Quest wouldn't understand these emotions. She wouldn't understand his glorious dream to create synthetic life so beautiful, so perfectly imperfect, that it could not be distinguished from the real thing.
"Then give her that. Give her what she wants. You've built a bioneuronic synthetic. Everything else will be trivial, a question of specialization."
"Aggie, This line of research won't go there.
You don't know that. Maybe it's a step on the way. Every synth we build is something new learned. Every synth we build is one more step toward the real goal. Don't you see? This is your work. Your real work. Everything we do, everything we have to hand over or is given to us, we can use that.
She reached out, took one of his hands in hers.
I believe in you, she said. I believe that you can do this.
They were close now. He had never stood so close to her before or looked at her so clearly. She was lovely, wasn't she? She was so present, so alive. She leaned forward, kissed him. He accepted, reciprocated. For a few moments, it was blissful, uncomplicated, the most human thing imaginable. And then he sprang back.
Shit, Aggie, I'm sorry. I shouldn't have... Shit, what was I thinking?
Her hand had been on his shoulder. She yanked it away and pulled back as if she had been slapped. Her face crumpled. She put her arms around herself like armor.
I'm sorry to hear I'm so repellent. God, Aggie, no, that's not what I meant.
I'm not some kind of toy. I have feelings, you know. I feel things. I'm not one of your damn plastic people.
They're not mine, he thought, but said, You're my student, for Christ's sake. Bruce, she said, I kissed you.
She moved toward him once again, laid one hand upon his chest and the other upon his cheek, as if claiming possession.
I am not a child.
No, he thought, as they kissed again. She was not a child, not at all. She was a partner, a confidant, a friend, someone to trust, someone to believe in him, someone who understood. The kiss became hungry, deepened. She came back to his apartment and stayed the night. In the morning when he woke, he watched her, pressed against the pillow, snoring very softly. He tucked a falling strand of hair behind her ear. When she woke, they made pancakes. She danced around the kitchen, wearing his shirt, singing Cloud Busting, and he thought, You are the only person who has ever understood me. I can do this with your help. I can do anything if you are beside me.
Verity.
The Kawat Milat not only aided the evacuation of Ingstis, they eased the passage of the fleet to Vashti. Picard and his crew found that the usual round of complaints and quarrels were quickly dealt with and diffused. They had, with the permission of the nuns, dispersed them in small groups so that there were a handful on each deck ready to dispense advice, rulings, and anything else that the Romulan guests needed, but for some reason did not want to ask from Starfleet. The remaining women took a group of adjacent quarters on Deck 12, where, with Zani's quarters in the center, a temporary convent was formed. Here the women came to train, sing, and work. The whole deck was quickly thrown open. The doors to each cabin set not to close, nets thrown up at need, and one room had the furniture removed so they could sit on the floor together and eat. Picard heard from other captains in the fleet that the same had happened on other ships. They set up schools, too, and daycare. He was content to let them get on with things. It all seemed to work very well. He asked Coley to go around the ship speaking to people, asking them to record short messages about their experiences so far. The resulting short vids were seized on with delight by Clancy at Starfleet Command, who tasked a small group of cadets to compile them into a documentary showcasing the success of the mission. They were 7 weeks into their journey to Vashti before the first and only serious incident of the flight took place. He was receiving an update from Captain Pecci on the Nightingale when an urgent message came in from Rafi.
Deck 12, JL, as soon as you can.
He gave his apologies to Pecci and made his way down. Rafi came to meet him.
What's the problem, Rafi?
One word, Tajuth.
She led him down the corridor toward the Abbey, explaining as they went.
It turns out that one of the people who came on board on Inxtis is wanted by the Tal Shiar,
Rafi said.
The Coat Milat gave him sanctuary 18 months ago. Tajuth has somehow gotten wind of this and decided to arrest this guy.
Any idea what he did?
Zani tells me that he was a cartoonist. Stupid pictures of politicians, that kind of thing. Only they touched a nerve. He got away from Romulus. Zani won't tell me how, but I get the impression of an underground railroad of some kind, and hid on Inxtis. The Tal Shiar don't go there much, as you might imagine. And now he's here on the Verity, and Tajuth wants him.
And the Coat Milat are not helping with his inquiries, presumably, said Picard.
You could say that, said Rafi, and pointed ahead. Picard saw 6 Coat Milat, 3 rows of 2, blocking the corridor, Tan Galanx in hand. Standing in front of them, black-clad and with his back to Picard, was the stiff figure of Tajuth. Peering over the block of nuns, Picard caught a glimpse of Zani in her blue robes, standing tall and resolute outside the door to her quarters.
"Oh, Tal Shiar," she said. "Please choose to live."
"Wow," murmured Rafi appreciatively. "They really are warriors."
Picard stepped forward.
"Lieutenant Tajuth," he said calmly, "can you explain what's happening here?"
Tajuth swung around. He was plainly angry. Picard had not seen him lose this much control before.
"They're concealing a wanted criminal. These damn women."
"Thank you. That's enough." Picard peered past the implacable rows of nuns.
"What are you hoping to achieve here, exactly?" "I want him in custody."
"I don't think that's going to happen," said Picard.
"It shall. It must."
"Lieutenant Tajuth," said Picard, "there are 2 ways past these women. I doubt you will be able to persuade them, and I will not permit the use of force."
"I demand that your security officers help me gain access. They are committing a crime against the Romulan government."
"Let me be clear. You want me to shoot these women?" Picard shook his head. "You know as well as I do that that will not happen. This is, to all intents and purposes, a Coat Milat province, and this is an internal Romulan matter. You're welcome to take the risk trying to enter, but you'll do it without Starfleet's assistance." Tajuth wavered. Picard moved closer.
"Let us talk about this in private," he said. "There is nothing to be achieved here, and a great deal of face to be lost."
Tajuth turned and marched back down the corridor. Picard followed. From behind the armed nuns, he heard Elnor's voice, high and clear.
"That Tuxat is an idiot."
Picard could not fault the boy's assessment. In his ready room, he turned on Tajuth, eyes flashing.
"This was wholly unnecessary. If you had concerns about anyone who had boarded this ship, you could and should have come first to me."
He saw Tajuth's mouth open to protest and cut straight through.
"Don't say that this was an internal matter. You were ready to ask me for my help to shoot these women, and with the boy present."
Tajuth tried to get himself back under control.
"They are harboring a criminal. They are harboring someone who has irritated someone in your government. His work lowers morale. I imagine there is more lowering morale than a few drawings, however barbed. Your mistake, by the way," Picard went on, "was choosing to fight this battle over a political prisoner. If you'd come to me claiming they were protecting a murderer, you might have found me more sympathetic. But the Coat Milat wouldn't do that, I imagine." "You're very sympathetic to them, Admiral." "They have been very helpful, Lieutenant," Picard said. "You're dismissed. I don't want to hear another word about this. If you want this man arrested, you can go through the appropriate channels when we reach Vashti. But don't try your luck again with the Coat Milat."
He sat down at his desk and heard, rather than saw, Tajuth leave. Later, Rafi groaned when he reported the conversation to her.
So, how's that killing with kindness going?
She said, with slight malice, he thought. I'm prepared to be patient, he replied.
Uh-huh.
Rafi did not look convinced.
Well, I'm prepared to bet on the death of the universe happening first.
But there was no more trouble on that voyage. Romulan Astrophysical Academy, Romulus. Nokim Vritet did not like having his routines disrupted, so he had been very unhappy when the small cafe where he ate his breakfast every morning had suddenly closed. Nobody cooked Votlik eggs the way that old Chimiyu cooked them. Nobody got the consistency right, neither too runny nor too thick, or used the right amount of gray pepper. It was most annoying. But there it was. Vritet had come out from his apartment one morning, only to find that the little eatery was locked and dark, and no matter how much he hammered on the door, Chimiyu did not appear, grousing and grumbling as he always did. Eventually, the woman in the flat upstairs leaned out of her window, told him to stop that bloody racket or she'd knock something out of him, and no, she didn't know where he was gone, but if he had any sense, he wouldn't be coming back. So much for his breakfasts, Vritet thought as he wandered sadly down the street to the tram. Over the following weeks, it proved surprisingly difficult to find a satisfactory replacement, not least because he couldn't seem to find Votlik eggs in the shops, and when he did find them, they seemed terribly expensive. Vritet, morosely, took to eating in the campus cafeteria, hardly his preferred option, since it was always so noisy, and he couldn't regularly get his preferred booth at the back near the courtyard, and there was always the terrible risk that colleagues or students might see him and want to strike up a conversation. This morning, after placing his order, he slipped to the back and took the empty table in the booth, blessedly surrounded on three sides by screens. He did not want to be disturbed. He had a great deal to think about. His plate of eggs arrived. Too watery, but at least the bread was decent for once. He laid out his notes in front of him. He was reading his report through for one last time before sending it upstairs to his superiors. Vritet's new data set had given him precisely the same results as before, and the model he had built had told him exactly the same thing. The supernova's range was much wider than believed, and the speed much faster. And this meant that the evacuation of Romulus should by now be well underway. He was sure of his work, of his own brilliance and eye for detail, but still, for the first time in his life, Nokim Vritet wished for a colleague to whom he could show his calculations and with whom he could discuss his findings. It would be good to have someone who could confirm what he knew. He had gathered dimly that other species ran scientific research in this way. Not Romulans. Somebody might be stealing your ideas or reporting you to the Tal Shiar for straying too far from permitted areas of research. Vritet glanced across the cafeteria. It was busy now, and people were looking for free space. A big man came and sat in the booth with him. Vritet quickly gathered up his notes, hiding them from view. He concentrated instead on his disappointing eggs and tried to decide what to do next. Nurius had retired, gone off-world, and had not yet been replaced. Vritet was not entirely sure now whom he should report to, and whether he should. But the figures said the same thing. If only he had someone to confide in, someone to tell him what the right thing to do was. So many lives depended on this. The big man opposite finished his breakfast, belched mightily, stood, and went on his way. Vritet watched him go, glad to see the back of him. Then he realized the man had left something behind, a little handheld device. He stood up to call after him, but the man was already through the door. Vritet reached for the device, intending to look for a name or some other identifying feature. As he touched it, the screen sprang to life. Odd, he thought. Why would it recognize his biosignature? He glanced down at the screen and saw the name Safadi. He began to read what was scrolling past, and his world fell apart. Vritet took the handheld back to the quiet of his office to study the contents more carefully. He knew Dr. Safadi's name, of course. She was one of the most respected figures in their field. He had sometimes wished that he could meet her, or at least communicate with her. But permits for communication with Federation citizens were very hard to come by, not to mention expensive, and he knew his family, who could afford the fees, would never allow it. Why would anyone want to communicate with someone from the Federation? They were scum. They were smug and overbearing, and held Romulans, even the best good-blooded Romulans such as him, in contempt. But now, somehow, he had come into possession of this paper. Well, not somehow. Vritet might be monastic in his habits, but he was not a complete fool. Whoever the man in the cafeteria had been, he had certainly intended Vritet to see this report. And for good reason. Safadi's data and her model exactly replicated Vritet's own work. For the rest of the morning, Vritet sat alone behind his desk and worried. He knew now, without doubt, that his calculations were correct. The blast radius of the supernova was well beyond official measures, and many more worlds were at risk. But what could he do? Whom should he tell? And how? And why? Why was nobody doing anything about it? Surely there should be information about the evacuation of the planet by now. Surely people should have left by now. Many, many people should have left by now. They wouldn't simply leave everyone. Would they? No, that was not possible. That was unthinkable. They were keeping the news quiet, of course, but they were organizing everything behind the scenes so that there was no mass panic. Surely that was the case. Then another idea struck him. Perhaps they didn't know. Perhaps Nureus, hurrying to leave, had forgotten to pass the information on. Perhaps Vritet was sitting here, the only person within the Empire who understood the threat. There was a tap at the door. Hastily, he concealed the handheld in his pocket. "Come in." It was one of the new members of staff, newish, he should say, the two of them had been here several months now, who had offices next to him. They had smiled once or twice, nodded greetings, but they had never talked to each other before. Vritet didn't make friends easily and didn't particularly want to. He wanted to work. She said, "I thought I'd drop by and say hello." She gave him a close look. "Is anything the matter? You look rather fraught." Vritet considered for a moment what to say. He could not reveal the device. There were identifying features on it that would lead back to his informer, and the man did not deserve that. But he could still talk about his data set. "I'm glad you came in," he said. "I'm very worried. Do you think you could take a look through these numbers?" Vritet went to bed feeling more cheerful than he had in some time. His colleague, Chokitha, had listened as he talked her through his figures and explained their ramifications. She had nodded when he told her his worry that the message had not got through from Nureus to the people that mattered. He was worried, very worried, that the necessary preparations were not being made. She had listened patiently, and when he was done, said, "I understand your fears. You should send your report up again. Send it to the director of the academy." It went against his nature to draw attention to himself, but with Chokitha's help, he wrote a short message and sent the report on. When this was done, she said, "Can I ask, what has made you so anxious about this today? From what you've told me, you've had these figures for some months." He didn't miss a beat before responding. Evasion was the first trick that all Romulans learned. "I thought I must have made a mistake, and so I took some new readings. I finished analyzing them today." No need to mention handhelds and strange belching men in cafeterias, and Dr. Amal Safadi.
I see,
she nodded.
Well, I hope I've helped.
There was something else preying on his mind, but he wasn't quite sure how to explain it. Chokitha, seeing his face, said,
Is there something else, Nokim?
There is something.
He glanced around and lowered his voice. I'm struggling to make sense of these readings. How they can occur. They don't fall within anything I would expect from this type of star. It's almost as if...
Go on, said Chokitha.
As if there's something unnatural about it. She blinked at him.
What do you mean, Nokim?
I mean, I can't find a natural explanation for this, but I don't know what it would mean for this to be, well, manufactured, done deliberately.
You're tired, she said, and you've been very worried. I'm sure when you look through your figures again, you'll see what you've missed. Go home, Nokim. Get some sleep. You don't need to worry any more.
She left. He tidied up his desk and turned off the light. How fortunate, he thought, as he walked home, that she had come past when she did, exactly when he needed some help. She was right. He would sleep well tonight, knowing that someone was going to act. He woke suddenly. There was a bright light in the room. He thought for a moment that he was dreaming, but then the light shone even brighter. His eyes began to water. A dark figure moved behind the light.
Who are you? He said. Who's there?
You know who we are, said a voice.
It was coming through an electronic filter. It sounded like a talking machine. Ritet shuddered. Things like that were the stuff of nightmares.
Your work is done now, Nokim, said the voice. We have your report. It's been passed on, and you should move on. Do you understand?
But has it reached the right people? Do they see what it all means?
Do you understand?
But the figures, the numbers. I must be sure that someone has them. Does the relief mission have them? Do they know how desperate the situation is? The evacuation? It should be well underway by now.
This is out of your hands now. It is no longer your concern. Your superiors have all the information that they need. They will act on it. Do you understand?
I understand.
Go back to sleep.
The light went out. He closed his eyes and lay there for a while, until exhaustion caught up with him. When he went to his office the next day, Chokitha's desk had been cleared, and his own had been searched. He touched the handheld in his pocket. Later that day, he destroyed it completely. North Station, Vashti. The Federation News Network was out in force on Vashti. Picard, with Rafi and Coley beside him as ever, walked over to join Commander Bowie, who had made the journey from Earth for this occasion. Lieutenant Call was at her right hand. Picard, remembering the young ensign who had taken such good care of him during his first hours commanding this mission, greeted her warmly. She was clearly delighted that he remembered her. Then Picard moved to speak to Kirsten Clancy. I'm grateful that you've made this journey, Captain. We're a long way out. She looked smart, neat, and unperturbed, the very model of a Starfleet functionary.
Well, you said that this one was going to be the big success, so we thought we'd throw our support behind you.
And what do you think?
Clancy looked around. He watched her clever, calculating gaze take in the square in which they were standing. Vashti was no Ryza, far from it. The sun gave the world a dry and dusty air. But the locals had done their best to give North Station a festival feel, to welcome the new arrivals due shortly to set foot on their world for the first time. There were ribbons and streamers and banners that said, Welcome to your new home, in both Standard and Romulan. The whole town, it seemed, had come out. There was a carousel and a Ferris wheel and a band playing in one corner. There was to be dancing later and the promise of fireworks. Rafi had said the whole thing reminded her of a school fair, but that made it no less heartfelt. Picard watched Clancy's face crack into a smile.
I think everyone on the council is going to love this, she said.
He tapped his comm badge.
Lieutenant the Kothrek, he said. Is Zani ready?
Whenever you are, Admiral.
Gesturing to Clancy to join him, Picard walked over to where the governor of Vashti and representatives from the local town were waiting, looking rather nervous in their finery.
Shall we begin? He said.
The governor nodded.
Picard tapped his comm badge and said, Lieutenant the Kothrek, proceed with the first group of guests, please.
There was a hush. Even the band stopped, and then the first 20 Romulans, all Kowat Milat, arrived on Vashti. Zani was at the front, Elnor beside her. The governor stepped forward and, with an anxious air, pressed his hands together as if holding a book, then opened them again.
Jolan Tru, welcome to Vashti. Our homes and hearts are open to you.
Picard, catching Zani's eyes, smiled. The governor had jumbled up the order of words slightly, and his Romulan accent was dreadful, but the sentiment was unmistakable. With infinite grace, Zani mirrored the gesture.
We thank you. We open our hearts to you and the homes that are to come.
There was a big cheer. When that died down and the band was about to strike up, Elnor stepped forward. His eyes were wide. He was staring at the Ferris wheel and, more particularly, at a unicorn waiting for a rider.
What,
he demanded imperiously,
is that?
A human child, a girl of about 7, slipped out from the crowd. She shoved her hand into Elnor's and dragged him off.
I'll show you,
she said, and helped him climb onto the beast's back. She jumped up behind him and wrapped her arms around his waist, and then they were off. The girl shrieked her delight. Elnor gave a grave smile. It could not have been better. The holo cameras caught everything and sent the images straight back home. Clancy looked pleased. Picard, breathing a deep sigh of relief, whisked her off to inspect the new houses that were being built and left his teams to get on with bringing the settlers down to Vashti. Later that evening, escaping the party to come back on board the Verity, Picard summoned his staff to join him on one of the starship's emptied decks, where partitions had been removed to open up a reception room. Champagne was poured, and he toasted them all, and the success of their mission.
Well done, all of you, he said. My deepest, most heartfelt thanks to you all for this great success.
To the Admiral,
someone called out, and they all took up the cry.
To the Admiral! To Admiral Picard!
Watching them, smiling and laughing, their tired faces shining with the knowledge of a difficult job well done, he believed that this was the happiest moment of his entire life. All the hard work, the trials and tribulations, the doubts, the struggles, everything was coming together. They had come together, and they were succeeding. To the Admiral. 9.
Admiral's Log. After 4 months, we leave Vashti, confident that the refugees whom we have brought here are settling in their new homes. The welcome they received from the local population is surely the most encouraging and even moving sight I have seen in my many years as a Starfleet officer. It epitomized all that I think is the best of the Federation. Open-minded, open-hearted, generous and curious. I have great faith that the Romulan settlement on Vashti will, in future years, be a byword for the success of this mission, proof that this great gamble of ours has paid off. As well as the welcome, we saw clear signs that the practical realities of settling so many people on the world were not being underestimated. The people of Vashti, both Romulan and human, will go to sleep for many years from now, listening to the pop-pop of archiprinters constructing their new homes and facilities. My understanding is that many small worlds along the border with the neutral zone resent diverting resources to the Romulans, fearing they would lose out. Vashti shows how an entire world may benefit. Captain Clancy was on Vashti for 5 days before returning to Earth. I have been keeping her informed. The messages I have received from her recently indicate that the images sent from Vashti have gone a long way to shoring up support. The sight of Elnor and the young girl making friends has proven particularly popular. I am both touched and charmed to think that this unusual boy now symbolizes this mission in the hearts and minds of many. Vashti, the Coat Milat, Zani, and Elnor all hold a special place in my heart. I believe that during this mission in particular, we have demonstrated how ambitious our work is, and how successfully it can be implemented. I am not so hubristic as to believe that our mission will be plain sailing from here on, but I do believe that as our experience grows, so does our ability to cope with whatever situations we may face. We become daily more fit for the task. If I did not take time to be proud of how far we have come and how much we have done, I would not be human. It would be remiss of me not to note how a large part of our success is due to Zani and her sisters in the Coat Milat, and continued success on Vashti will depend in large part on them. A personal note. It has been a privilege for me to have met her and to have established our friendship. From the start of this mission, and despite the numerous setbacks we have faced, not least the lack of openness from the Romulan government, I have always had faith that somewhere within Romulan space I would find a kindred spirit, someone whose values were congruent with mine, someone who understood that when life is at risk, all must be risked to save it. When I left Vashti, Zani said to me that the gifts we had brought were beyond measure. I would say that the gifts she has given me are at least as great. Counsel, comradeship, and courage. If I should ever doubt this mission again, and I have no doubt I shall in the coming days, I will think of Zani and of Elnor, for whom she risked all. But now we must leave Vashti in her capable hands and turn the Verity and the rest of the fleet toward our next mission. I hope we shall have at least some of the success of this last one, but preliminary reports indicate that we face a considerably more difficult situation than that we found on Inxtus. The border world of Nimbus III, despite the hopes invested in it at its foundation, has historically been a lawless place, a haven for black marketeers and other malcontents. My understanding is that in recent years, the inhabitants have worked hard to bring law and order to their world, and that this has only been achieved recently and at considerable cost. I will not be surprised to meet resistance here. A home so hard won will not be easily surrendered. This is one of the many small tragedies of this catastrophe. Rich or poor, young or old, no one can escape the effects of this disaster. It is our task to protect those who cannot protect themselves. Nevertheless, as we proceed toward Nimbus, I find myself turning as ever to Lieutenant Coley and relying on her advice to tackle those who do not wish to leave their homes. Cambridge, Earth. Spring had come to Cambridge. A sweet season in a temperate region of a planet that had learned from the calamities of the past and had organized in order to do what was needed to save all its species and the world itself. Dr. Amal Safadi, waking to see that it had rained during the night, foresaw a lazy Sunday morning ahead. Catching up on her reading, biking into town for brunch with friends, a swim later at Jesus Green. As she passed by her desk on her way to the kitchen to put on the coffee, however, she saw a little red light flashing on the screen, indicating she had received a communication from someone she had flagged as crucial. She hesitated,
thinking of her plans for the day, but she knew that she would not relax, thinking about that flashing light. She sat down and opened the message. The message was from Haig at Romulan Affairs at Starfleet. A brief text note saying, "This just in. Important. Get back to me as soon as possible." She knew Haig didn't waste words. Important meant what? Game-changing? She opened the file he had sent over, her trepidation rising as she saw the author of the report. Nokum Vritet. Surely this is good news, she thought. A communication from Vritet? Perhaps it signified movement on the part of the Romulan authorities, an indication that they were willing to start sharing the information that they had about the supernova. Safadi respected Vritet, and she also knew how good her own work was. Vritet was surely writing to confirm that his figures bore out hers. She was rapidly disappointed, indeed shocked, at what she read. Vritet's report stated in the strongest terms that his latest set of figures did not replicate hers, that her revised estimate of the blast radius was vastly overstated. He confirmed that he had received Safadi's figures via his students at the Cambridge Symposium, that he had analyzed them numerous times, and that he had compared them to datasets that he had acquired from several sources back on Romulus. Safadi noted that these were not included. She could not believe what she was reading. The worst part of the whole message was the note that had been attached by the Romulan intelligence officer who had sent the report to Haig, his opposite number. "We are at a loss here to understand what Dr. Safadi intended when she produced her malicious report, or indeed, what the whole team at Cambridge was hoping to achieve when they gave institutional backing to her efforts. We are trying to assume it was in good faith, given Starfleet's continued insistence that they are acting in the same fashion. Nevertheless, these are difficult times for us, and it is hard not to believe that some mischievous or unfavorable intent was behind Safadi's work. Why else would Federation scientists, who we all know are directed in their work by Starfleet, make these outrageous and inflammatory suggestions? We are well aware that these claims, if they became public, could create chaos across the Empire. This is a very serious matter, and should any evidence come to light that such was the intent, we would consider it a prelude to war. Let us remind you that the Romulan Star Empire will not take attempts at destabilization during this trying time lightly. If such was the purpose of this report, we must insist that your government more carefully scrutinize work being conducted in this field and ensure that its scientists are held to the highest standards. At the moment, we are not convinced that this is the case. Safadi sat back in her chair, shocked. Had Vritet honestly dismissed her work out of hand? For a moment, she doubted herself. Had there been a mistake? A slip? It was so easy to get too close to your work. But that was what the team was for. That was why you had people around you. Check the work. Check the thinking. That had been the point of the symposium, to take the group's findings and bring them before the wider scientific community and get them to make sure that there were no errors. That was how the whole thing worked. Besides, Safadi was able to judge her own work, and she was sure, completely sure, that there was no mistake. What the hell was going on? Her comm chimed. Dernium Bekri, looking worried, appeared on the screen. "Amal," she said, "I got Haig's message. Have you read Vritet's report?" Safadi nodded miserably. "What is happening?" "I don't know," Safadi said. This can't be right. Something must have happened at Vritet's end. I can't believe he would falsify results. Do you think he doesn't have access to the data?" "I honestly can't say. All I know is, my model is right. You know that too. So do the others. So does everyone we showed the study to." "I know, I know." Safadi looked anxiously at her friend's face.
Dunyam, some of the things they were saying.
Malicious, she thought, and shuddered.
Is this going to be okay?
I'm not sure. Listen, there's more. I got a message from Counselor Olivia Quest. Have you heard of her?
Yes.
If you took an interest in the castes at all, and Safadi liked to be well informed, then it was hard to miss Counselor Quest these days. Not that Safadi could remember the world that the counselor came from. She was slightly embarrassed by that. Maybe these small worlds had a point about how easily they were forgotten.
Isn't she the one heading the Relief Mission Oversight Committee?
Yes, and she's very keen to speak to us in the light of all this. She's sent a message asking us, you and me, to come and speak to the committee. I say ask, but it's more a summons. You won't believe this bit, Amal. She reminded me that she has the right to compel us to attend.
She doesn't need to compel me to attend a committee hearing. It's my duty and my pleasure.
But what is she expecting us to say?
That we're very sorry and we made a mistake adding up, and that they should cancel the mission?
I don't think you'll need to go that far. But we'll need to be prepared to explain the figures in the simplest terms possible. Quest is an engineer, but she's not our only audience. The ordinary person is.
Safadi cut the comm.
She stared out the window where the bright sun was refracting through the water drops on the glass. Outside, on the garden fence, a blackbird, hopping along, stopped dead and turned one inquisitive eye toward her before flying away in search of breakfast. Safadi opened her files.
So much for a lazy Sunday.
Verity. Admiral Jean-Luc Picard, receiving his weekly update from Mars, sat and listened as LaForge ran through his figures. In truth, Picard had few concerns. The Daystrom A-500s were proving a boon to the mission, and they were on schedule for rolling the first batch of specifically designed Wallenberg-class ships off the production line by the start of next year, as long as there were no more surprises. But then there was only so much for which one could prepare. Life did not run like clockwork. Other people, light years away, made decisions that you knew about, and others that you would never know anything about. Eventually, the consequences were felt and had to be dealt with. He cleared his throat.
Admiral, you've stopped listening, so why don't I stop talking and send you this file, and you can tell me what's the matter?
Some people knew you far too well. My apologies, Geordi, but you're right. I've seen that people from the Institute of Astronomy in Cambridge have been asked to appear before Counselor Quest's committee, and that there is some query over their calculations.
Yeah, I've read that report, too. There's some very unhappy people in Romulan affairs right now, I bet.
Do you think there's any truth in it?
Do I think Dr. Safadi made a mistake?
Picard nodded.
You know, Admiral, those people are smart. I mean super smart. Not only at what they do, but in the way they go about doing it. There are checks and balances. She published, damn it. People have been poring over her figures for months. The most high-profile piece of research in decades. There'll be someone out there dying to make their name by proving her wrong. But if it is wrong, I bet Safadi and her people would want to be shown how and why. And if they've made a mistake?
LaForge held up his hands.
Well, that's good news all around, isn't it? I have half a dozen people here who would be happy to get back to their old projects.
Do you think Safadi's report is solid?
LaForge wrapped his knuckles against his desk.
Solid as Mars rock. Whether she can persuade that committee, though, well, that's another question entirely.
He sighed.
I should go. I have a genius at the Daystrom Institute to harass. LaForge out.
Picard smiled. He turned his mind back to Nimbus 3. Dr. Amal Safadi could surely take care of herself.
Federation Council, Paris, Earth.
Safadi, sitting outside the committee room, watched Dernium being interviewed. She thought about how she used to joke that her mother didn't have a clue what she did, but loved to see her on the news.
Well, Mama, be careful what you wish for.
Dernium was acquitting herself well, answering the questions clearly and carefully, explaining the composition.